Okay, we are back studying the discipline called natural theology, or the subject of natural theology, and we made it actually all the way up to page 31. And you'll remember, because it's been a while since we've met, but you'll remember I introduced you to an individual named Thomas who's been living in a cave for a number of years. And I, last time we talked, we waded through some of the alternative worldviews, and we offered this as a kind of a priori argument for God's existence. If you rule out all the competition, what remains is theism. And so on page 31, I say that it is indeed asking a lot to expect poor Thomas to wade through every possible worldview and discern that all non-theisms are self-defeating or insufficient or imprudent. But the defender of the ontological argument is asking this man in the cave to do no such thing. Indeed, the defender of the ontological argument is asking all of us to simply contemplate the idea of God. If anyone would simply do this, then he would realize that the mere idea of God is proof of the reality of God. To put it another way, if you can think of God, you have proven that God is real. While this might at first glance sound strange and even incredible, please note that some of the greatest minds in history have taken this argument very seriously, and that would include people not only like Anselm and Descartes, but even Bertrand Russell. Now, Bertrand Russell was never convinced by the argument, but, well, he was. He was convinced by the argument for a brief second. He was walking down the road one day, and he was throwing his tobacco can up in the air and catching it. And he threw his tobacco tin up in the air, and as his eyes were gazing on the tin can that was about to begin its descent downward, he said to himself, "Oh, the ontological argument is sound." And so for one brief shining moment in his life, he was actually convinced that God exists through this argument. He did recover, of course, and became one of the leading atheistic philosophers in history. But here's what Anselm says, and this is a very long prayer that Anselm gives, but he says this. He says, "And so, Lord, do thou who dost give understanding to faith, give me, so far as thou knowest it to be profitable, to understand that thou art as we believe, and that thou art that you are that which we believe, and indeed we believe that thou art a being than which none greater can be conceived. Or is there no such nature, since the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God? But at any rate, this very fool, when he hears of this being of which I speak, a being than which nothing greater can be conceived, understands what he hears, and what he understands is his own understanding, although he does not understand it to exist." All right, so what's he saying here? He's saying, we believe that God is the greatest conceivable being, and even the fool has that understanding of God in his head. He's rejecting that. And so, even though he doesn't understand it to exist, he does have that in his understanding. Does that make sense? "For it is one thing for an object to be in the understanding, and another to understand that the object exists. When a painter first conceives of what he will afterwards perform, he has it in his understanding, but he does not yet understand it to be, because he has not yet performed it. But after he has made the painting, he both has it in his understanding, and he understands that it exists, because he has made it. Hence, even the fool is convinced that something exists in the understanding, at least that than which nothing greater can be conceived. For when he hears of this, he understands it, and whatever is understood exists in the understanding. And assuredly, that than which nothing greater can be conceived cannot exist in the understanding alone. For suppose it exists in the understanding alone, then it can be conceived to exist in reality, which is greater. Therefore, if that which nothing greater can be conceived exists in the understanding alone, the very being than which nothing greater can be conceived is one than which a greater can be conceived. But obviously this is impossible. Hence, there is no doubt that there exists a being than which nothing greater can be conceived, and it exists both in the understanding and in reality. And it assuredly exists so truly that it cannot be conceived not to exist, for it is possible to conceive of a being which cannot be conceived not to exist, and this is greater than one which can be conceived not to exist. Hence, if that than which nothing greater can be conceived not to exist, it is not that than which nothing greater can be conceived. But this is an incredible contradiction. There is then so truly a being than which nothing greater can be conceived to exist, that it cannot be conceived not to exist. And this being thou art, O Lord our God. So truly therefore dost thou exist, O Lord my God, that thou canst not be conceived not to exist, and rightly. For if a mind could conceive of a being better than thee, the creature would rise above the creator, and this is most absurd. And indeed, whatever else there is except thee alone can be conceived not to exist. To thee alone, therefore, it belongs to exist more truly than all other beings, and hence in a higher degree than others. For whatever else exists does not exist so truly, and hence in a less degree it belongs to it to exist. Why then has the fool said in his heart that there is no God, since it is so evident to a rational mind that thou dost exist in the highest degree of all? Why except that he is dull and a fool? All right, so this is a reductio ad absurdum argument. Do y'all have any questions about what he's saying here? We're doing good?
Well, it says that if you can think of God, you have proven it true.
Yes. It says you can think of God.
So if you can think of God, you have proven that God is real. So what's the argument, I guess, if you could think of the truth fairy or like what Dawkins, the seven-eyed spaghetti monster, mm-hmm. I mean, you can think of that. Does that prove that it's real?
Right. But, that's the question.
Right.
And he says in there, he goes, every other creature or every other being we can conceive of as non-existent, but we cannot conceive of God as non-existent. Why? Because God is the greatest conceivable being. That's his argument. Again, we're just trying to understand right now. I will say that right after I quoted these words in this chapter, I set forth an attempt to debunk the ontological argument. And so the whole point of this chapter was to be to show, okay, the ontological argument doesn't work, but there are these other arguments that are really good. But I read Stephen Davis's book, God, Reason, and Theistic Proofs, and I read his defense of the ontological argument, and I was persuaded by it. And that changed my whole perspective on these kinds of arguments. Let me skip over to the next page, and we're going to be looking at page 33. And I say here that we're going to focus on Stephen Davis's discussion of the ontological argument in his God, Reason, and Theistic Proofs. And I think he's given one of the best defenses of it. There's another version of the ontological argument we'll look at later, which is Alvin Plantinga's version, and that's actually more popular. But it was not Plantinga, it was Davis that convinced me, so we're going to look at Davis. He says this, Davis says the following. He says, the ontological argument will constitute a successful proof of the existence of God if and only if two conditions are satisfied. First, the notion of a being than which nothing greater can be conceived is a coherent notion whose only possible referent is God. And two, the ontological itself is a sound argument. The second condition actually includes the first, of course. The ontological argument couldn't very well be sound if Anselm's term for God were incoherent. But it is useful to think of there being two separate conditions here. Okay? So is the notion of a being than which nothing greater can be conceived a coherent notion whose only possible referent is God? In answer to the question, Davis correctly notes that a being than which nothing greater can be conceived is often referred to as the greatest conceivable being or the greatest possible being. Is this appropriate? Are the concepts a being than which nothing greater can be conceived or a greatest conceivable being or a greatest possible being all the same are so very nearly the same so as to justify the equation? On this question, Davis notes that there is one point in which the being than which nothing greater can be conceived and the greatest conceivable being seem to differ. Namely, the term GCB, the greatest conceivable being, entails that the being in question can be conceived by some conceiver or other, while the term a being than which none greater can be conceived does not necessarily entail this. is this difficult issue impossible to overcome? Davis says no, and he justifies his claim with the following insight. He says this: let us assume a premise that seems quite beyond reproach, despite the fact that it is not an explicit part of Anselm's argument, namely, that ability to conceive of oneself is a great-making property. In a moment, he will explain what great-making property is, but I think all of you kind of intuitively know what it means to be a great-making property, right? A great-making property would be something like being powerful, right? Or being knowledgeable. That is, if we have two beings, A and B, who are alike in greatness as much as possible, except that A is able to conceive of itself and B is not, then A is greater than B. If this is so, it follows that for any being that cannot conceive of itself, no matter how great this being is, we can conceive of a greater being, namely one just like it in every possible way, except that it is able to conceive of itself. The being, then, which nothing greater can be conceived than, must be a being that can conceive of itself, and the two terms, a being than which nothing greater can be conceived, and the greatest conceivable being, turn out to be equivalent. What is a great-making property? A property is great-making if it makes something better than it would be without the property. For example, I have the ability to run, which means that I am greater than I would be if I did not have that property, especially if there's a tiger after me, right? We should notice, then, that greatness in this context speaks to one's power, abilities, and freedom. And this is what really caught me. The reason I didn't accept Anselm's argument before is I thought he was being ambiguous about what it meant to be great. But what Davies does is he's actually given a specific definition of what it means to be great, namely, one is greater than another if it has greater freedom, greater abilities, and so forth. The freer something is, the greater it is. A boulder has the power to crush me, but I am greater than a boulder, for I have the power to move my own, to move of my own accord. I can run out of the way if I see a boulder falling towards me. A mind that can discern the fact that a boulder is falling towards me, and the wisdom to make tools that can be used to break the rock up into little pieces, is a great-making property in the sense that it makes me greater than the rock. Notice also that the greater something is, the more godlike it is, for God is the greatest conceivable being. Davis points out that some properties are relevant to greatness or likeness of God, while others are not. For example, the property of being redheaded is not a great-making property. What is the most redheadedest conceivable being? Does that make sense to all of you? It shouldn't. Okay. We intuitively recognize that being redheaded does not necessarily make a person greater or more godlike than having blonde hair. However, the property of being all-powerful has to be a great-making property, right? Because a being who is all-powerful is necessarily greater than a being who is not. And the same can be said of the property of being all-knowing. Imagine a being who is all-powerful but not all-knowing. We can imagine someone greater, namely a being who is both all-powerful and all-knowing. Also imagine a being who is all-powerful and all-knowing, but not all-good. But we can imagine an even greater one. All-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good. Indeed, we intuitively recognize that knowledge is power, and that power not tempered with goodness actually turns into a weakness. Okay, and we actually have examples in our life about that going on. Have you ever heard someone say, that guy had such great potential, but he let this vice get in his way? I've heard of people various times, if it weren't for his, and then fill in the blank, his alcoholism, his drug addiction, his womanizing, whatever, if it weren't for that, he would be, you know, governor of Georgia or president of the United States. So power not tempered with goodness is a weakness, and therefore a being who is all-powerful and all-knowing and all-good is obviously greater than any being that lacks one of those properties. The greatest conceivable being, then, is a self-conscious or personal being who possesses all great-making properties that are compossible with each other. But omnibenevolence, omnipotence, and omniscience are three great-making properties that are logically compatible with each other. And it even seems that the property of omnipotence entails both omniscience, and omnibenevolence. Hence, the greatest conceivable being is at least a self-conscious personal being who is all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good. Y'all have questions about that? Does that seem obvious to all of you? Some properties have degrees, and others do not. Examples of properties which do not admit of degrees would include being a prime number, being 6 feet tall, being a cow, being a non-cow, being a human, a bat, a grain of sand. These properties do not admit of degrees, since after all, something either is or is not a human. It either is or is not a prime number. It either is or is not a bat, and so forth. The property of being tall does admit of degrees. Some tall people are shorter than other tall people. Now, of those properties which admit of degrees, some have an intrinsic or conceivable maximum, and others do not. Being tall has no conceivable maximum. This is another thing that he said that convinced me that the argument was sound. If you think about it, if you're going to argue that the mere idea of something entails the reality of something, it has to not only have great-making properties, but the great-making properties it has to have intrinsic maxima. There are some degree properties that do have an intrinsic maximum and some degree properties that do not. You have a question?
I just kind of wanted to clarify that the definition of greatness, so kind of like the two traits that he seems to be honing in on are autonomy from our thought. Even though we're conceiving of it, the greatest conceivable being exists whether we want it to or not. And then it also deals with its capacity to affect reality. Kind of like you were saying, I can have a certain degree of power or influence over the boulder. In the same way, this greatest conceivable being has the greatest conceivable sway and authority over reality.
Right. So if God were dependent upon the ontological argument for his existence, then God would not be the greatest conceivable being. So not only does God have to be our greatest thought, but God has to be greater than any thought we have of him. Right? So our thoughts can in no way determine who and what God is. Now, our knowledge of God's existence may be dependent upon the ontological argument. I've already shared with you the fact that I don't think that that's true, because I think there are other ways we can know God. But this is one way in which our knowledge of God is dependent upon this argument. But that's a different issue. That is epistemology instead of ontology. All right, how are we doing? So, as Davis notes, there are some degree properties that do have an intrinsic maximum, and then there are some that do not. We've already pointed out that the tallest conceivable being is a contradiction in terms, because the word tall, even though it is a degreed property, it doesn't admit of an intrinsic maximum. However, there are other degree properties that do admit of intrinsic maxima. Imagine an 18 out of 18 golf score. That's a golf score that cannot be bested. You can't do better than 18 holes in one, right? So if I were a golfer, and every time I went out on the course, every time I played, I got 18 holes in one, then I would be the greatest conceivable golfer, right? Because a golf match doesn't, it's a degreed property that admits of an intrinsic maximum. Now, it seems obvious that the property of having knowledge is also a degreed property that has an intrinsic maximum. We can conceive of some beings having more knowledge than others, but a being who is all-knowing or omniscient is a being whose knowledge is insurpassable. No other being can have more knowledge than one who's omniscient, nor can such a being know more than he himself knows. Goodness also admits of degrees, for we know that some things or persons are morally better than others. And we submit goodness has an intrinsic maximum, for we think it is bizarre for someone to insist that a person is more moral than a morally perfect entity. The same can be said of being all-powerful. It is clear that some possible beings are more powerful than others. Hence, the property of being powerful is commensurable. This property does admit of degrees. And a being who is omnipotent is a being whose power cannot be bested. Hence, there is an intrinsic maximum to all three of these fundamental properties of God: being omniscient, being omnipotent, and being omnibenevolent. Now, I got into a long discussion with an atheist one time who argued that omnipotence is an incoherent idea. And his argument was this: if you put God in the weight room and he goes and he lifts 100 pounds, then you could say, well, can you lift 101? And obviously, as the all-powerful being, he could lift 101 pounds. Well, can you lift 102? Well, obviously, I can bench press 102, 200, 400, a gazillion pounds. The all-powerful being could lift that, right? I could always keep conceivably adding one more piece of weight to the bench press, and God would be there to lift it. He could lift that weight. And therefore, omnipotence does not admit of an intrinsic maximum, and therefore, omnipotence is an incoherent idea. So my question to all of you is, how do you get around that argument?
The initial thought that I have is of kind of an infinite capacity for power versus a finite capacity for power. I think that the finite by nature are very limited capacity to affect reality measured against an infinite and unlimited capacity to affect reality kind of shows the difference in degree between our power and the next. There is a limit to what we can do, and what the greatest conceivable being can do far surpasses that limit to an extent that we can never approach it.
So do you think that he's confusing who God is or what God is with what God does? Here's what I said to him. I said that you're confusing the attributes of God with the activities of God. No activity of God could ever fully reveal what God is. This is why a lot of your theists are wrong to think that, say, a miracle like the resurrection proves the existence of God. It doesn't. It doesn't prove the existence of an all-knowing, all-powerful, all-good being, because a less than all-powerful being could have raised Jesus from the dead. No miracle could ever, by definition, reveal omnipotence. There's only one exception that I would give, and that is creation. The ability to bridge the infinite, qualitatively infinite gap between nothing and something seems to me to be an expression of omnipotence. But that even that doesn't mean that God's power is exhausted in the act. Because if you're an omnipotent being, even creation will be child's play. No action. The question is, that's not to say that the attributes of God are wholly separated from his actions. No, it was the omnipotent being who did X, Y, or Z, right? Say a biblical story where you have the resurrection. Those actions do not exhaust his omnipotence, for example, and therefore if you see an event in history, this is where the presuppositionalists get it right. I see an event in history. The worldview that I'm reading that event from or in light of is going to determine how I interpret it. But I can't say there's a fact, and that fact is obviously a miracle. And that not only proves God's existence, it proves that the God who exists is all-powerful. It doesn't prove God's existence because I'm reasoning in a circle. A miracle, by definition, is an act of God. And so I can never say that's a miracle and use it as a proof for God without arguing in a vicious circle. And second of all, the God that it proves in my linear attempted a linear deductive argument doesn't get us to an all-powerful being. It just gets us to, at most, a really powerful being. This is why non-believers will always opt for something other than God as the cause of the resurrection, even if you get them to the resurrection. They'll say, well, maybe aliens did it. Well, see, that's not logically impossible. It's not logically impossible to think that maybe someday aliens will conceive of a technology that can resurrect or resuscitate a body after being dead for a couple of days. You know, that's just not inconceivable. So maybe some aliens were flying by, they looked down, and they said, let's play a joke on these humans, right? Let's raise this guy from the dead. So you already have to be a theist before you even look at the resurrection and see what it proves and what it doesn't prove. Does the resurrection prove anything? It proves that Christianity is true, but it doesn't prove that God exists. Okay? And so, it doesn't faze me at all that for every amount of weight I put on a bench press, I can always put more for an all-powerful being, because God could, by definition, never exhaust his power in any act in creation. Now, when we defended minimal theism, we did look at the stone paradox, and in the stone paradox, that was, can God make a rock too heavy for him to lift? And one way to answer the stone paradox, and if you're a minimalist, is to say, well, God could have just chosen never to create the rock. But if he does choose to create the rock, then he loses his omnipotence. Right? Now, since I'm arguing ontologically now for God's existence, we're going to have to change our answer to the stone paradox. We're going to have to revisit it, because that answer won't do. Because what we're trying to argue now is that God is all-powerful necessarily, and that there's no logically possible world in which an all-powerful being doesn't exist. Because the statement God does not exist actually entails a contradiction. So we're going to have to revisit the stone paradox. But do you have any questions before I take the next step in this conceptual exercise here? Well, here's the next question. Should we equate the terms greatest conceivable being and greatest possible being? This is a more difficult issue, for the words conceivable and possible can each be defined in more than one way. It is true indeed that we can draw the limits of conceivability wider than the limits of possibility. I can conceive, in some sense of that term, of married bachelors or equal to them. Married bachelors, in the sense of the term, are inconceivable. But surely, as long as philosophers simply stipulate that for them, conceivability means the same thing as possibility and use the terms consistently, there is nothing objectionable about equating these two terms. And this is the very move that Davies makes in his discussion of the argument. Hence, the greatest conceivable being and the greatest possible being are logically the same. Okay? Now, let me say one thing. Notice that he's not introducing into this idea the greatest imaginable being. Because what I can conceive and what I can imagine are not the same thing. 1,000-sided geometric figure is conceivable. But in my mind's eye, I cannot imagine such a thing. Try to do it right now. Okay? But you would all agree with me that it's perfectly possible for there to be 1,000-sided geometrical figure, even if you can't imagine it. So when you say conceivable, that's not the same thing as imaginable. And so some people will say, oh, I can't conceive of a God. No, you know, you can. You just can't imagine God, because God is so beyond most of your categories of experience that that's your problem. But you're confusing imagination with conceivability. And those are not the two. Those are not two of the same. Those are not the same thing. What does the word greater mean in Anselm's argument? We've answered this question already. Davis elaborates. He says, sadly, this is one of the gaps in Anselm's argument. Anselm nowhere said exactly what he meant by greater, or what it is that constitutes greatness for a being. But we can, as it were, try to work backward and figure out what he must have meant, or at least what his argument requires. That is, we can ask what notions of greatness might make the ontological argument succeed. There is some textual evidence that Anselm wanted us to interpret greatness in terms of goodness, but I prefer to follow another path. If we read greatness as, say, redheadedness or running speed or largeness, the ontological argument will clearly not succeed. There logically can be no redheadedest conceivable being, fastest running conceivable being, largest conceivable being, tallest conceivable being, and so forth. And that should be clear to all of you, right? But if we read greatness as power, ability, freedom of action, where the GCB, or the greatest conceivable being, is then omnipotent, the ontological argument just might succeed. Perhaps other notions of greatness would also make the ontological argument succeed. I make no exegetical claim that this notion of greatness is Anselm's intended notion, although it is clearly in the spirit of the concept of God he worked with in the Proslogion and the Monologion. Nor do I claim that power is the only great-making property for beings or persons. I claim merely that my criterion is intelligible and has a chance of allowing the ontological argument to succeed. We have finally arrived at the issue before us, namely, is the term greatest conceivable being coherent, and is God its only possible referent? With regard to the second question, it seems clear that, given everything we have said so far, that being which possesses all compossible great-making properties is, by definition, the God of theism. By great-making, of course, we mean those God-like making properties which make God, God. By compossible, we mean those properties which are not only great-making, but are logically compatible with each other. Can the properties of omnipotence, omniscience, and omnibenevolence all inhere within a single entity? There seems to be no prima facie reason to think not. Hence, these great-making properties are compossible, and as we have seen, the concept of omnipotence entails both omnibenevolence and omniscience. So if I can conceive of an omnipotent being, I must also conceive of that being as both all-knowing and all-good. In short, the greatest conceivable being must be at least all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good, but these are core attributes of the theistic God. Thus, the greatest conceivable being just is God. But is the term coherent? Is it coherent to speak of a greatest conceivable being? The term greatest conceivable being is coherent just in case two propositions are true. First, beings can be compared with each other in terms of greatness. That is to say, greatness is a degreed property. And second, greatness must admit of an intrinsic maximum. With regard to our first requirement, it seems clear that while some notions of greatness are not commensurable, 3 cannot be more of a prime number than 7, others are. Indeed, given our understanding of greatness as referring to power, ability, and freedom of action, it is clear that a number of things can be compared to one another in terms of greatness. Swans are more powerful than stones. Humans are more powerful than cats. The President of the United States is more powerful than the Mayor of Washington. Also, even if we were unable to compare various beings with each other in terms of their greatness, the ontological argument could still be sound. All Anselm strictly needs is that all beings be comparable in greatness with God. So even if there are two beings, X and Y, that are not comparable with each other in greatness, that is, it makes no sense to ask which of them is greater, the ontological argument can still succeed just as long as it is still true that both X and Y are less great than the greatest conceivable being. Can we say that greatness is a property that admits of an intrinsic maximum? Not on some definitions of greatness. However, given Davis' definition of greatness, there is an intrinsic maximum to this property. As Davis writes, there logically can be no more powerful being than a being who is omnipotent, as defined above. And what is the definition of omnipotence? An omnipotent being is one who is able to bring about any state of affairs that is not logically impossible to bring about at that time. That's the definition of omnipotence that he's working with. It looks then that both conditions for the coherence of the concept of the greatest conceivable being are satisfied. Beings are comparable with respect to greatness, and greatness does admit of a maximal case. Hence, there is nothing incoherent about the notion of a greatest conceivable being. The only question left to answer is, does the ontological argument succeed? Is it sound? And here's the argument. On page 39, the argument is outlined as follows. Things can exist in only two ways, in the mind and in reality. the greatest conceivable being can possibly exist in reality. That is, it is not an impossible thing. The greatest conceivable being exists in the mind. Whatever exists only in the mind and might possibly exist in reality might possibly be greater than it is. The greatest conceivable being might possibly be greater than it is. Excuse me, I skipped a point. Number four says, whatever exists only in the mind and might possibly exist in reality might possibly be greater than it is. And premise five says, the greatest conceivable being exists only in the mind. The greatest conceivable being might therefore be greater than it is. The greatest conceivable being is a being than which a greater is conceivable. It is false that the greatest conceivable being exists only in the mind. Therefore, the greatest conceivable being exists both in the mind and in reality. Okay, so that's the outline of the argument. Let's look at each premise and see if we can defend each one. Number one, things can exist in only two ways. Something exists in the mind just in case someone imagines, defines, or conceives of it. Something exists in reality just in case it is real independently of or apart from a person's conceiving it to exist. And it exists as a concrete thing that has causal properties. Hence, there are four ways in which a thing can exist, namely, in both reality and in the mind but not in reality but not in the mind, or in neither reality nor the mind. All right, so let's look at examples. A thing can exist in both reality and in the mind. George W. Bush. Okay, are y'all going to dispute that? He exists in my mind, but obviously George W. Bush exists independently of me, right? In the mind, but not in reality, Travis Campbell's 10th daughter. I can conceive of me having a 10th daughter. Do I have a 10th daughter? No. Okay? So that's conceiving something in the mind, but it's not in reality. In reality, but not in the mind, some undiscovered chemical. Maybe there's way out in Alpha Centauri a chemical out there that we just haven't discovered. So it's in reality, but it's not in our minds. And then an example of something that is in neither reality nor the mind, automobiles in the first century BC. Right? People were walking around. I'm pretty sure no one conceived of such a thing in the first century BC. And even if I'm wrong about that historically, we can at least imagine, right, a world in which no one can conceive of an automobile, but and automobiles don't exist. An iPhone, yeah. All right. Now, this premise does not seem objectionable at all. Things that exist, quote-unquote, is either mere ideas, real but unimagined things, real ideas, or unimagined and unreal notions. Since this premise is true, we move on to the next premise, namely, the greatest conceivable being can possibly exist in reality. That is, it is not an impossible thing. And that premise has already been established, has it not? There is no contradiction in the concept of a greatest conceivable being. Hence, it either exists or contingently fails to exist. I exist. Squared circles necessarily fail to exist since they are logically incoherent. And my 10th daughter contingently fails to exist. Do y'all know what it means to contingently fail to exist?
It's a condition that has to be met in order for the existence to occur.
Exactly. So a contingent existence is, one way to define it is a conditioned existence. All right. The 12th planet in our solar system fails to obtain. Why? Because certain conditions in our solar system were not met for it to obtain. So it's a contingent falsity. I mean, it could exist. It just happens not to. So my 10th daughter contingently fails to exist since she could possibly exist, but just happens not to. And no law of logic necessitates that the greatest conceivable being failed to exist. So even if the greatest conceivable being did not exist, the greatest conceivable being could exist. And that's all we need for this premise to get through. Next, the greatest conceivable being exists in the mind. This is not to say that everything that is true of the greatest conceivable being exists in the mind of everyone who has ever lived. Indeed, no human person can understand in a comprehensive way everything that the greatest conceivable being is. Anselm's point, and by extension Davis's point, is that his term for God, the greatest conceivable being, exists in the minds of at least some persons. Everyone who has at least conceived of God has at least understood this term for God. That is to say, God is the greatest conceivable being. Therefore, the greatest conceivable being exists in the mind. All right, now here's the key premise. Whatever exists only in the mind and might possibly exist in reality might possibly be greater than it is. Davis explains this as follows. The intuitive idea here is that things are greater if they exist both in the mind and in reality than they would be if they existed just in the mind. Anselm was not comparing different sorts of things. He was not saying, for example, that a given clod of dirt in the flower bed in my front yard, since it exists in both ways, is greater, in the sense defined earlier, than Paul Bunyan, who exists only in the mind. He was comparing the same thing in different modes of being. He was implying, for example, that the clod of dirt is greater than it would be if it existed only in the mind, and that Paul Bunyan would have been greater than he in fact is had the legendary woodsman existed in reality as well as the mind. In terms of our earlier definition of greater, Anselm should accordingly be taken as suggesting that things that exist both in the mind and in reality are more powerful, freer, more able to do things than they would be if they had existed merely in the mind. Is Harry Potter greater or not as great as he would be if he actually existed? If Harry Potter really did exist, then would he not be greater than he in fact is? Imagine, he can act, there's a real guy who can now walk around performing magic spells on people. Okay? Now, if you agree with that premise, that if something exists in the mind and could possibly exist in reality, then its existing in reality would make it greater than it in fact is if it had only existed in the mind. I don't know how else to explain this, but do y'all have any questions about that? Does that seem clear to you? Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
So is that to say then that, just working through this, if can't we conceive of a Harry Potter in the mind that would actually be greater than the Harry Potter that we're thinking of now, that can cast some sort of better spell than we know him to be able to cast right now, and we could still create that in our mind?
Yes.
Or are you saying, does it have to exist in reality first?
Yes. Yeah, I can in my mind right now conceive of a Harry Potter that is greater than he appears in the actual story. So, for example, imagine a Harry Potter who, at the age of 11, could defeat Voldemort in a witch battle, in a cursing battle, right? I can imagine that Harry Potter to be greater. Or a Harry Potter that graduates from Hogwarts and doesn't face Voldemort until later in life, so he faces him at the age of 30, and he's therefore more powerful than he is in the story when he faces Voldemort at the end.
The point of what you're saying is, though, once what's in our mind then becomes reality, what's in reality will still be greater than that.
Right. Okay. So, the Harry Potter who is 11, who's actually casting witch spells, is going to be greater than the Harry Potter that merely exists in the mind, even if I were to conceive of him at 30 casting witch spells, right? Because the witch spell, he's not determined. The Harry Potter of the story is wholly determined by the imagination of J.K. Rowling. And a Harry Potter that really exists is not going to be so determined. George W. Bush is in my mind in reality, and therefore he is greater than he would be if he only existed in the mind. I mean, for example, my mind would never have conceived of George W. Bush being an artist. But little did I know that after he left the White House, he took up art and then wrote a very touching book about soldiers that suffered in the war, and he actually did paintings of them, and And then he did a book tour raising awareness for helping out those who suffered in the Iraq conflict. How are we doing? All right, so this premise here, number five, is the premise that you're actually going to try to refute. But you have to put it in there because, remember, the ontological argument is a reductio ad absurdum. It's trying to demonstrate that atheism is self-contradictory. Well, you can't demonstrate that atheism is self-contradictory unless you have this next premise in the argument. So, the premise is that the greatest conceivable being exists only in the mind. Anselm, and for that matter, all theists, he does not believe that this premise is true. I don't believe that this premise is true, and I don't think any of you do either. But this is the atheistic premise. It is being accepted as true merely for the sake of proving its incoherence. Remember, the ontological argument is a reductio ad absurdum, attempting to show that if one assumes that the greatest conceivable being does not exist in reality, then one is believing something that is incoherent. In short, the proposition God does not exist is a logically contradictory proposition, or at least entails a logical contradiction, which to me is basically the same thing. So that's the atheistic premise, and we throw that in there, and then we ask the question, what follows from the atheistic premise? What follows from the statement, the greatest conceivable being exists only in the mind? Well, it immediately follows that six, the greatest conceivable being might possibly be greater than it is. Okay? When premise five is added to premises one through four, this sixth premise automatically follows. The only possible problem with the sentence we encounter is the difficulty some have with what this premise says about the ontological status of the greatest conceivable being. To what does the mere concept of a greatest conceivable being refer to? The answer is that if one assumes premise five, it refers to nothing outside the minds of those who entertain the concept of the greatest conceivable being. The greatest conceivable being is non-existent, has properties, for even a non-existent greatest conceivable being has the property of being a concept and can be referred to. It is certainly possible to refer to a non-existent property-bearing thing. Indeed, it is perfectly coherent and true to make the following claims. Paul Bunyan is a woodsman. Travis Campbell's 10th daughter is female. Darth Vader is a Sith. Luke Skywalker is the son of Darth Vader. All of these wholly imaginable or imagined beings have properties. These things we are describing are simply possibly existing things. Pets. That's what these things are. They're pets. Possibly existing things. Some pets actually exist. For example, I exist, and I'm a pet. I'm a possibly existing thing. The same is true of the reader of the chapter. All you guys are pets. Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and so forth. Such pets are concrete objects, while Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker are merely possibly existing abstract things. Davis writes, there certainly can be mere concepts of pets, but a pet is not just and without remainder a mere concept. Thus, a non-existent greatest conceivable being can best be thought of as a set of compossible properties that constitute a pet. And premise six is to be taken as saying that the greatest conceivable being, a non-existent pet, might be an existing pet, and that if it were an existing pet, it would be greater than it in fact is. Okay. So do you see how six follows from five? I'm going to let you guys think about this for a second because this is very important. If you agree with premises one through four, and then we throw five in there, we basically say atheism is true, the greatest conceivable being only exists in the mind, then six automatically follows. The greatest conceivable being might possibly be greater than it in fact is. Example, Harry Potter exists only in the mind. Therefore, Harry Potter might possibly be greater than he in fact is. The greatest conceivable being exists only in the mind. Therefore, the the greatest conceivable being might possibly be greater than he or it in fact is. Those two statements should have parallels, right? Or those two statements are perfectly parallel with one another. They're perfectly the same. And if it applies to Harry Potter, it must apply to the greatest conceivable being. But if you are, okay. Where did I get off the rails? Did you follow me all the way up to four?
Yeah.
Okay. So whatever exists only in the mind and might possibly exist in reality might possibly be greater than it in fact is. So Harry Potter exists only in the mind. He's just an imagination. So therefore, Harry Potter might possibly be greater than he in fact is. Because he could exist in reality. There's nothing logically impossible about Harry Potter existing in reality. By the way, all movies are really explorations into logically possible worlds. Star Wars is pretty much physically impossible. The laws of physics will not allow a planet like Tatooine to exist where you have two suns. It goes around two suns. It's not possible physically. But it's possible conceptually. It could exist. Because the laws of logic are broader than the laws of physics. It's possible that you can have this laser that arbitrarily stops midair and you can use a sword out of it. It's probably physically not ever going to happen because the laws of physics will stop that from happening, but we can conceive of it. So Luke Skywalker could exist. And if Luke Skywalker did exist, he would be greater than he in fact is, because a really existing Luke Skywalker is greater than a merely imaginable one. Y'all, are you on track now? Well, that means that if the greatest conceivable being exists only in the mind, then the greatest conceivable being might possibly be greater than it in fact is. But if 6 is true, then 7 automatically follows. The greatest conceivable being is than which a greater can be conceived. And that is a contradiction. I think that the reason so many people have a hard time following the argument is because 7 is so absurd. They're like, why would that follow logically? Well, that's the point. An absurdity has followed logically from these very logical statements that have led us up to this point. If you agree with premises 1 through 4 and throw in 5, then 6 and 7 follow. This, and I'm going to read the defense of premise 7, this automatically follows from premise 6. For if the greatest conceivable being could be greater than it in fact is, we must conclude that the greatest conceivable being is a being than which a greater can be conceived. But since this statement is an obvious contradiction, indeed nothing can possibly be greater than the greatest conceivable being, we must reject one of our earlier premises. The defender of the ontological argument sees premises 1 through 4 as either necessary truths or premises that are demonstrable. At least they are more plausible than their negations. 6 through 7 follow from 5. And that means that 5 is the culprit. What is 5? Again, 5 is the greatest conceivable being exists only in the mind. And 5 entailed 6 and 7. 6 is the greatest conceivable being might possibly be greater than it is. And 7 is the greatest conceivable being is a being in which a greater can be conceived. Now, because we have to reject 5, therefore, because 5 entailed the contradiction, 5 messed us up, we have to get rid of 5 and replace it with premise 8. It is false that the greatest conceivable being exists only in the mind. But if, as premise 1 states, there are only two ways a thing can exist, in the mind or in reality, and if, as premise 3 states, the greatest conceivable being at least exists in the mind, and if, as we now see, the greatest conceivable being does not merely exist in the mind, we must then conclude that the greatest conceivable being exists both in the mind and in reality. This, of course, is what the theist has always believed. Indeed, God is the greatest conceivable being. And since that which exists both in the mind and in reality is greater than that which exists in the mind alone, we must conclude that God exists in reality. Therefore, the proposition God exists is analytically undeniable, since its negation entails a contradiction. And that is the argument. Is this an absolute proof? Absolute certainty that God exists? You bet. That's what I'm proposing. I'm absolutely 100% convinced that God exists. Okay. Don't shy away from that either. Don't go, it's all about faith. No, no, it's not all about faith. It's all about what's real. The issue is fact. This is not a faith issue, boys and girls, or boys. This is a fact issue. Okay? And the question is, does God really exist? Well, if I had no other reason to think so, I would say I'm absolutely 100% mathematically certain that God exists. If I had no other argument and I only had this one, I would say yes because of this argument. We're going to start going through objections, but do you have any, we have 40 minutes. So do you have any questions about this? Anything you want me to go over before we look at the objections? All right, we'll go back to 7. So 7 is the greatest conceivable being is a being than which a greater can be conceived. That is an absurd, moronic statement. Right? It's just a logical contradiction. You cannot conceive anything greater than the greatest conceivable being.
What about the greatest conceivable being's older brother?
If I can conceive of a... Okay, that would be a good question. So how does this not entail polytheism? Well, let's hypothetically say that maybe there's more than one greatest conceivable being. Then so be it. Then we've ontologically proven polytheism.
But doesn't that cause problems with the greatest conceivable being? How are
there two? I agree with you. I don't think that there can be two all-powerful beings. But let's assume for a moment I'm wrong about that. That wouldn't hurt the argument. That would just hurt theism. If you go, well, what about the greatest conceivable being's older brother? I would say, okay, well, then if the greatest conceivable being's older brother is also all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good, then so be it. Then we have two greatest, two alls. Now, why do I not believe that an all-powerful being can admit of two? Why do I not believe that you can have two all-powerful beings? Well, I think that the power of one is always going to cancel out the other. Here's another way to put it. And I'm very glad you asked that question because tomorrow I'm doing my last talk on the Trinity. And if you want to come to Sunday school and listen to me do my last presentation, in fact, we may have to do something in the afternoon together, or I might just come in here and record because I don't know if I can get it all in. But because I'm asking the question, how can there be processions of God and not subordination? So that's my talk tomorrow. But I will say this: Anselm, of course, is a strong Trinitarian, and he would be the first to say, there are not two all-powerful beings. And I will even say this, since we're defending Abrahamic theism right now, Muslims and Jews out there would look at you and say that's impossible to have two all-powerful beings. And that's why Christianity is so stupid, because it just gives us this bad mathematical equation, right? And the seeker after truth at least has to say, well, if the Trinity is a contradiction, then so be it. I can't be a Trinitarian. By the way, I do believe that. If the Trinity were logically contradictory, I would not be a Trinitarian. Now, there's one thing to consider. There is the principle of the identity of indiscernibles. Okay? And what is the principle of the identity of indiscernibles? If you have two things that are really, truly, absolutely distinct from each other, one has to have at least one property or at least something that distinguishes it from the other. Right? If you didn't have that, they would be indiscernible, and therefore they'd be the same thing. So imagine that I talked to you about two people that I've met recently. I met a guy named Clark Kent. And this guy can type really fast. He's in love with a reporter named Lois Lane. And he is just, he's amazing. And he's always places where you'd never expect him. I mean, you blink your eyes, the guy is in Paris doing a report for the Daily Planet up there in New York City. They sometimes call it Metropolis, right? And sometimes, I mean, you blink your eye, next time he's in Buenos Aires. I mean, my gosh, you blink your eye again, he's in Mexico City covering this recent tragic earthquake that happened. I mean, he's all over the place. But you know what? I met someone even greater than that, and that is a guy by the name of Superman. And what's interesting is there's a little love triangle going on here because he's also in love with Lois Lane. And he flies so fast, they think he might approach the speed of light in his ability to fly. And he's everywhere at once, too. Okay? Now, you all know where I'm going with this. If we were to study Clark Kent and Superman very closely, we would start to realize that there is no property or attribute that distinguishes Clark Kent and Superman. And so after a while, we would have to say what? They're the same person. So if you're going to postulate two greatest conceivable beings, the question is, what great-making property is one going to have that the other does not have? And the minute you give me an answer, I would say, well, the one that lacks it is not the greatest conceivable being. Right? Because all great-making properties are upheld or had or possessed by the greatest conceivable being. Yeah, if the brother of the greatest conceivable being could give the greatest conceivable, he had noogie-making power, and it would be a power that the greatest conceivable being lacked, then guess what we have to do? We have to change our allegiances, and we would have to say the brother is the greatest conceivable being and not this other being that we're talking about. Remember, if you can conceive of a greater than God, then that would be God. Okay. How are we doing? So seven is secure? Yeah.
Can you briefly go over again the connection between 5 and 6 and 7?
Sure. Very quickly. Let's go over the connection between 5 and 6 and 7 again. We're all agreed that 1 through 4 is good, and 4 is whatever exists only in the mind and might possibly exist in reality, might possibly be greater than it is. We're all good on 1 through 4. 5 does not logically follow from 4. Okay? That's one thing that you need to know. It's not a logical entailment from 4 at all. It's the atheist premise. Imagine the atheist is in our discussion, and we hammer out 1 through 4, and the atheist smiles and he says, okay, but look, God doesn't exist. Translation, the greatest conceivable being exists only in the mind. He's a fig Newton of your imagination. That's all he is. And we say, okay, all right. Let's put that down as a premise and let's see where we go with that. Well, what automatically follows from that, that God is a fig Newton of your imagination, is that God might be possibly greater than he is. Yeah, and what would be the conditions that made him greater than he in fact is? Him existing in reality. Now, if you say 6, God might possibly be greater than he is, or the greatest conceivable being might possibly be greater than he is, then you have to say 7, God is a being than which a greater can be conceived, or the greatest conceivable being is a being than which a greater can be conceived. And since 7 is an absurdity, we have to ask ourselves the question, what created this problem? Was it 1 through 4? No, it was 5. 5 is the bad guy. 5 is the culprit. And atheism, therefore, entailed this contradiction. And therefore, atheism cannot be true. It's not just that atheism is highly improbable. Atheism cannot be true, logically speaking. To say that atheism is true is the same as saying that 2 plus 2 equals 5. Yes.
And to clarify, before we do move on to, I think you were saying some of the objections to the ontological argument. To clarify, the ontological argument does not establish the identity of the greatest conceivable being, merely its existence.
Correct. If by that you mean which religion is true, I guess. We've not proven any specific religion. I don't think Anselm thought that he established Christianity as the truth. And so one of the problems here, I'll be talking to atheists sometimes and they'll say, well, your God is obviously not the greatest conceivable being. Look at all these terrible things God did in the Bible. I'm like, wait, time out. I'm not talking about whether the Bible is inspired or not. I'm not talking about whether all those stories in the Bible are true. We're not even on that page. We're simply talking about whether there is a God. Now, obviously, the biblical writers believed that God is the greatest conceivable being. We're actually going to give quotations of the Bible in here in a minute. Maybe not in a minute, but next week or whatever. But we're gonna look at quotations in the Bible which actually says this about God. So obviously I'm not denying that we're talking about a biblical conception of God. But they want to, the people that attack me whenever I'm arguing for God's existence that are atheists are always wanting to open up the Bible and give a critique of God. And I want to say, I believe that God existed before I opened up a Bible and really took it seriously. Okay? Now, again, I am Reformed, and I think that without a context where biblical theism was a norm, these kinds of arguments would have never been articulated anyway. But the point I'm making here is the argument is sound, regardless of what you think about anything else. So let's not confuse the soundness of an argument for a God, which is compatible with biblical theism. Don't confuse that with, say, an argument for the inspiration of the Bible. If I were saying, and this therefore proves that the greatest conceivable being inspired the Bible, well, then you could open up the Bible and start trying to show how these stories are false or whatever.
So we've established that there is a God, just not necessarily who that God is yet.
Right, exactly. You're exactly right. Anybody else before we move on? Objections. And so what I do here is I go through every single objection to the ontological argument that I'm familiar with. I leave no stone unturned here. And this intrigued me because I was like, whoa, this is a really good argument. So let's revisit the objections. And some of these objections were handled quite well by Davis. And then some of these objections are really classical arguments. I do not plan on reading through every single one of these to you. I mean, obviously, you can read through them yourself. But let's look at some. But let's start off with the quote by Immanuel Kant. Kant says this. He says, the attempt to establish the existence of God, of a supreme being, or the existence of a supreme being who we call God, by means of the famous ontological argument of Descartes, is therefore merely so much labor and effort lost, we can no more extend our stock of theoretical insight by mere ideas than a merchant can better his position by adding a few noughts to his cash account. The most fundamental objection to the ontological argument is summed up in these words. Here's the bottom line. And when I say that, I mean these words of Kant. And here's the bottom line. It is impossible for a person to move from pure thought to reality, regardless of how pure those thoughts might be. To be sure, the basic objection is rarely stated as a mere assertion. It is usually backed up by an argument and or an illustration. And so what we're going to see over and over and over again is this basic presupposition coming through. You can't move from thought to reality. You can't say that just because this is possible, that therefore means that it actually exists. Here's my basic thesis. God is not like other things. Just because I can conceive of Harry Potter, that doesn't mean that Harry Potter exists. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Why would the greatest conceivable being be? Why would that require a process of us being moving that thought to reality?
Yeah, you're exactly right. I think that a lot of people seem to look at arguments for God's existence, and we addressed this just a few moments ago, but they seem to look at arguments for God's existence almost as if our arguments create God. Like God didn't exist until we knew he existed. And I want to say, no, God's existence does not depend on any proof we have of him. And so, obviously, I'm not saying that I can move from just the mere thought of God and then conjure him up through an argument. I'm saying that I come to an awareness of God when I realize that the denial of his existence entails a contradiction. And here's my thesis, therefore. God is not like other things. What is the greatest conceivable Harry Potter? Well, that admits of no intrinsic maximum. That's person relative, who the greatest conceivable Harry Potter is. One who killed Voldemort when he's in the crib. One who grew to maturity and could handle his power and temper it with goodness and kill him at the age of 30. Right? There are two conceptions of Harry Potter, by the way, one in the film and one in the books, right? Because he doesn't do all the things in the film that he does in the books and vice versa. So which is the greatest conceivable Harry Potter? Which is the greatest conceivable pizza? What is the greatest conceivable Lost Island? My bottom line is those kinds of things do not admit of an intrinsic maximum. What I would like to do is therefore skip the first objection that Davis covers. It's the ontological argument commits the Boy Scout objection. And number two, the ontological argument assumes that we can conceive of God. I'll let you handle those on your own because I just don't think that those problems have any real weight. Yes, we can conceive of God, but that doesn't mean that our conceptions of God comprehend God. God is our greatest concept, but he is also greater than any concept we have of him. So Anselm didn't get trapped into this idea that the ontological argument destroys the incomprehensibility of God. So God is still worthy of worship, right? So on page 45, though, here's the classical objection. This is the Lost Island fallacy. Gonalo was a monk who lived at the same time as Anselm. Anselm died in the year 1109, and Gonalo offered this Lost Island objection. And here's what Gonalo says. He says, if a person can conclude that God exists by simply defining him as the greatest conceivable being, then we can come up with a parallel argument, a parody, for a lost island. Namely, there is in my mind a lost island than which none greater can be conceived. Therefore, such an island exists. Gonalo says, and I quote, if a man should try to prove to me by such reasoning that this island truly exists and that its existence should no longer be doubted, either I should believe that he was jesting, or I know not which I ought to regard as the greater fool. Myself, supposing that I should allow this proof, or him, if he should suppose that he had established with any certainty the existence of this island. Gonalo's point, even if I can't locate exactly where the fallacy of the argument resides, there is one thing I know for sure, namely, the fallacious reasoning behind the ontological argument can be used to prove anything. And if you can use that argument to prove anything, then you have to reject the ontological argument. You can just prove Lost Islands exist, that Harry Potter exists, or whatever. Anselm responded to Gonalo's objection in the following way. He said, now I promise confidently that if a man shall devise anything existing either in reality or in concept alone, except that than which a greater cannot be conceived, to which he can adapt the sequence of my reasoning, I will discover that thing and will give him his lost island, not to be lost again. Anselm went at great lengths to show that the greatest conceivable being was a different kind of thing than a lost island. But as Davis rightly suggests, Anselm seems to have misunderstood Gonalo's objection. Gonalo's point is that if we accept Anselm's argument, we could use his line of reasoning to prove anything, and no one wants to do that. Do you see why an argument is bad if you can just use it to prove anything? Here's an example. God exists because the Bible says so. Well, why believe the Bible? Because it's the Word of God. Well, how do you know it's the Word of God? Because it says so. All right. Well, I can use that line of reasoning to prove anything. God exists because the Quran says so. How do you know that the Quran, what it says is true? Well, because it's the word of God. You can see how this goes. So it's a bad line of reasoning. If you can use line of reasoning to literally prove anything, then it's a bad line of reasoning. Well, Davis, on the other hand, makes two points which seem to overcome the lost island objection. First, how would Gonolo define his greatest conceivable lost island? He himself states that his lost island is an inestimable wealth of manner of riches and delicacies and greater abundance than is told of the islands of the blessed. Davis fleshes out Gonolo's lost island in the following way. The greatest conceivable lost island is the greatest conceivable member of the set of lost islands because it possesses to the maximal degree all those great-making properties that islands can possibly have. These would presumably be properties like the beauty of the scenery, the temperature, the amount of sunlight, the taste of the coconuts, power to provide shade and shelter, power to flourish flora and fauna, and so on. But if the greatest conceivable lost island is conceived of in these terms, and it seems that there's no other way to conceive it, then it turns out that the properties had by the greatest conceivable lost island have no intrinsic criteria of greatness. What is the greatest conceivable temperature? What is the greatest conceivable color of water? What is the greatest conceivable scenery? As Davis well notes, these are all mere matters of taste. Secondly, Davis says, and I quote, these sorts of great-making properties have no intrinsic maxima or discernible limits. Take the notion of tallest conceivable human. This notion is not explicitly contradictory, but it is still clearly incoherent. No matter how tall we can imagine a certain human being as being, we can always imagine or we can always conceptually add another inch and thus show that it was not the tallest conceivable human. Thus, there logically can be no tallest conceivable human. Similarly, there logically can be no greatest conceivable lost island because the greatness will be measured, like height for a human, in terms that have no intrinsic maximum. What exactly is the greatest conceivable degree of good taste for a coconut? What is the maximum degree of ability to flourish flora and fauna? Okay, do y'all see the problem there? Now, this brings us to my very favorite, all-time favorite objection to the ontological argument. And with this one, we're going to end our talk today. So we're going to get out a little bit earlier than I even anticipated, because the next objection we're going to look at is Immanuel Kant's objection, and most people think that Kant was the one that destroyed the argument. So in a lot of ways, I'm hitting softballs, and then when we get to objection 5, we're going to actually have to hit a curveball, right, a fast-breaking curveball. But let's look at my favorite one, though. This is really fun. A person can give an ontological argument for the devil. Let me tell you all a little story. This chapter has been around for a number of years, and when I first wrote it, I gave it to my class at the high school that I teach at, and we went over the ontological argument, and I went over this objection to them. And the very next year, one of the girls that took my class, she went on to University of Georgia, and she took a philosophy class, and in the philosophy class, there were like 200 students or so, and they took their final exam, and their professor basically gave them two essay questions that they had to answer. One essay question was a question that he had covered in class quite thoroughly. But the other question was, construct and critique an ontological argument for the devil. And my student smiled with glee because she, the night before, had read over my material. And this is a great notch in my belt, so I'm very proud of this moment. And she looked around. She said that the students all in the auditorium, they were just crying. They were just weeping because they had no clue as to how to answer this issue. She, out of the 200 students that took this class, there were two that got an A on the exam, and she was one of them. So this is practical. I guess if you're ever sitting in a philosophy class, you might run into this argument. This is a little bit different than the lost island objection because we're actually saying that maybe we could use it to prove another supernatural being. So God is not like all the things we run into, right? But neither is the devil. So could you reconstruct this reasoning process to give us an argument for the devil? If the devil is real, he, if he is real, is a much different kind of thing than what we normally see around us. And so David and Marjorie Haught have used the following argument to show that the devil is real. And here's the argument. I have a concept of something than which nothing worse can be conceived. If that something did not actually or in fact exist, it would not be that than which nothing worse could be conceived. Because something could always be conceived to be much worse, which is to say something that actually exists. The worst conceivable something is what we would call the devil. Therefore, the devil exists. Now, there are Christians out there that are tempted to go, hey, you just proved another plank in our worldview. Because Christians traditionally believe that God exists, and they also believe that the devil exists. At least classically speaking, Christians believe that the devil exists. And therefore, this does not hurt the theistic worldview at all, because we've proven two beings that Christians always have believed that exist, God and the devil. Now, my question to all of you is, what's wrong with that common Christian response, or at least that possible Christian response? Hey, this argument doesn't hurt us at all because it's proven something we all agree with or all agree to anyway.
Well, for one, it doesn't, to me at least, on the surface, seem to differentiate the power of God and the power of the devil.
Okay.
Being that they're basically both the greatest, in other words, we'll use good, greatest conceivable good and the greatest conceivable evil. It doesn't really show maybe the degrees of power or how the two are different. Or then you have, brings in, what is their difference? Is it good and evil? Mm-hmm. What differentiates these beings other than the greatest conceivable good thing, the greatest conceivable bad thing?
Okay, very good. So it doesn't do a good enough job to distinguish these two.
Two, following on what Nathan said there, at least in the iteration of the argument that we're seeing here, all they're saying is something than which nothing worse can be conceived. So we just have a something instead of a being, at least in this wording.
Okay, you're critiquing the argument right now, which is good.
Right.
I'm just asking, let's say that the argument follows through. Would that be good news for the Christian? Hmm. All right, so in other words, the devil's been proven. Is that a bad thing, that we've proven the devil through this means? What if we've proven that it is logically impossible for the devil not to exist? Because that's what this argument is trying to prove. What if we prove that we've proven that if the ontological argument is sound, we've proven that it is logically impossible for God to not exist. In other words, God's non-existence is an impossibility. Or to put it another way, God exists in all logically possible worlds. Because to say that God does not exist entails a logical contradiction. And since the laws of logic are universal, they govern all logically possible worlds, then God must exist in all logically possible worlds. You have a...
So the devil would share the same kind of omnipresence and logical essence as God.
Yes. If the devil is a logically necessary being, then the devil is just as eternal. This is maybe another way of saying what you were saying. All right. So this is what Nathan was trying to say. And you were just doing it from a different vantage point. You were saying we're confusing the two. What I'm saying is basically what you've proven is Zoroastrianism. Remember, Zoroastrianism is the worldview called bi-theism. This is that there are two eternal principles, a good one and a bad one, and they've been at war from all eternity. And what this would basically mean is that evil is just as necessary as the good is. So remember what George Burns said to the little girl in Oh God, Book 2, that really great theologically sound movie. She goes to George Burns, she goes, why do bad things happen? He goes, have you ever heard of an up without a down? You've ever heard of hot without cold? And she keeps going, no. And she's smiling. He goes, if you're going to have good, you got to have evil. Well, see, that's anti-Christian. That's anti-Abrahamic theist, because God is a logically necessary being. God is good. Good is necessary, but evil is not. That's why the problem of evil is so problematic, you see. So you can't get out of this argument by going, oh, so you've proven the devil, so what? No, 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 this is not good news for the Christian. All right, so any questions about that? The defender, as I say on the bottom of page 47, of the ontological argument need not fear that his line of reasoning can prove the existence of the devil or that God and the devil are the same. This becomes clear when we note that, according to most traditional theists, evil cannot be conceived of in positive terms. Evil is, by definition, a lack of that which is good. For example, when we notice that someone is blind, we do not say that the eyes, as such, of the blind person are evil. Rather, it is what the eyes lack which is evil. We will be developing this point in chapter 4, but suffice it to say here that there is nothing inherently contradictory or incoherent about understanding evil in this way, nor is our definition of evil less plausible than premise A of the devil's ontological argument. Now, the point I'm making here is, even if my understanding of evil is false, as long as it's logically possible, I've obstructed the flow of this argument. Does that make sense? So, the reader can easily see how our understanding of evil undermines the argument for the devil when he realizes that evil, since it is, after all, a parasite on the good, has no intrinsic maximum. Since evil is a parasite on the good, it is certainly possible to conceive of the good without evil, but no one can ever really conceive of evil without the good. Thus, no matter how evil a good thing might become, we can always think of a worse. Even Hitler petted his German shepherd, so I can think of a worse than Adolf Hitler, one who abused his dog, Blondie. Yeah.
So good is a logical necessity because it is positive. It's that which exists.
Yes.
Right. Whereas evil is something that actually, rather than that bi-theistic view that you were talking about where they're constantly set against each other, evil is something that does depend on the existence of good because it is it's some kind of flaw or defect, yes, in that which does exist. But good does not in turn rely on evil. It is something that exists even apart from those flaws.
Right. Your only hope for an optimistic view of the future is to say something like this. If you say that evil and good are equal, or that evil is just as eternal as good, then there's no basis for saying that evil will ever be conquered. Because if evil is logically necessary, then the good will never conquer the evil. And if you say, of course, that evil is greater than good, then you're even worse off. So what is the metaphysical foundation for the Abrahamic theist eschatology that one day all rights will be wronged by the coming of God and his kingdom? That metaphysical foundation is founded in the fact that that evil need not exist, but the good must exist, and therefore the good must conquer the evil. One cannot conceive of a worse conceivable being. The only reason this notion might be prima facie intelligible to someone is if he is dwelling on an idea with a rather vague understanding of the word evil or worse. Once these ideas are understood in terms of privation or lack of being, or some relevantly similar notion, premise A of the devil's ontological argument needs to be rejected. Hence, the ontological argument for the devil is unsound, and therefore the reasoning behind the ontological argument cannot be reproduced to prove the existence of anything other than God. I had an atheist student one time who was sitting in my class, and he goes, "I just reject your definition of evil." And I said, "Fine, but as long as my definition of evil is possible, you can't prove the devil through this line of reasoning, and therefore you cannot dismiss the ontological argument as Arthur Schopenhauer called it, a bad joke. You can't just dismiss it like that by saying that you can parry to the argument in this way.
What did he do with it, or what do they do with it?
Schopenhauer was following in the wake of Immanuel Kant, and so the best thing for me to do is for you to wait to have that question answered until next week, when we look at Kant's objection. But I will say in general, your average philosopher who thinks that this argument is a joke think so because they think that you're just moving from pure thought to reality in an arbitrary manner. This is just wish fulfillment. And as I'm indicating here, I just don't think that's the case. All right, well, I'll see you guys next week.